50s, remained alive. Chase wrote to Lincoln, explaining that the death of his sister precluded his attendance at the traditional New Year's reception. "Without your note of today," Lincoln promptly replied, "I should have felt assured that some sufficient reason had detained you. Allow me to condole with you in the sad bereavement." One of the guests at the White House reception noted, "A great contrast between this New Year's and any previous one for the past 3 years. 4 years ago, there was a solemn stillness, a burthensome weight hanging upon the minds of all, a fearful foreboding of evil, a dread of the future. It was but little better 3 years ago, or 2 years ago. Even 1 year ago, we could scarcely see any light. Today, all are in good spirits." The stunning success of Sherman's March to the Sea, which had ended with the capture of Savannah on Christmas Day, was largely responsible for the ebullience that prevailed in Washington. "Our joy was irrepressible," recalled Assistant Treasury Secretary Hugh McCulloch, "because it was an assurance that the days of the Confederacy were numbered." The president had initially been anxious, if not fearful, about Sherman's plan to abandon his supply lines and trust that his men could forage for necessary food and provisions along the way. The day after Savannah fell, Lincoln recalled his skepticism in a gracious note to Sherman. "The honor is all yours, for I believe none of us went farther than to acquiesce." Sherman's march to the sea proved devastating to Southern property and countryside. Frank Blair, whose troops played a major role in the historic march, rationalized the indiscriminate destruction in a letter to his father. "We have destroyed nearly 400 miles of railroad, severing the western from the eastern part of the Confederacy, and we have burned millions of dollars' worth of cotton, which is the only thing that enables them to maintain credit abroad and to purchase arms and munitions of war, and we have actually gobbled up enough provisions to have fed Lee's army for 6 months." Though the military gains justified the march in the minds of Union soldiers, the memory of its terrible impact on civilian lives haunts the South to this day. In his congratulatory note to Sherman, Lincoln also paid tribute to General George Thomas, who had defeated Hood's forces at Nashville 10 days earlier. "News of the two victories," Lincoln wrote, "brought those who sat in darkness to see a great light." The telegram announcing Thomas's victory had been carried to Stanton in the middle of the night. "Hurrah!" Stanton cried as he hurriedly dressed and rushed to the White House with Thomas Eckert, the chief of the telegraph office. Eckert would long remember the delight on Lincoln's face when he heard the news. Standing at the top of the stairs, in his nightdress, with a lighted candle in his hand, the tall president created an arresting tableau. The fall of Fort Fisher, which guarded the port of Wilmington, North Carolina, followed in mid-January. Headlines trumpeted the "combined work of the Army and Navy," which had gained the capture of the fort and its 72 large-caliber guns. "This glorious work," hailed the National Republican, "closes the port of Wilmington and shuts off supplies to the rebels from abroad." Gideon Welles was ecstatic, recording that at the cabinet meeting that morning, "there was a very pleasant feeling. Seward thought there was little now for the Navy to do. The president was happy." The defeat was shattering to Southern logistics and morale. Confederate Vice President Alexander Stephens considered the fall of Fort Fisher one of the greatest disasters which had befallen our cause from the beginning of the war, not excepting the loss of Vicksburg or Atlanta. With nearly every other port closed by the naval blockade, the closing of Wilmington signaled the complete shutting out of the Confederate states from all intercourse by sea with foreign countries, bringing an end to the exchange of cotton for vitally needed munitions and supplies. Stanton was in Savannah, Georgia, for a conference with Sherman when the rebel flag of Fort Fisher was delivered to him. Eager to see the battleground, he journeyed to North Carolina, where he spent the night with General Rufus Sexton and his wife. When he arrived, he warned his hosts that fatigue would compel him to retire early, but relaxing before the fire, surrounded by a collection of books, he revived. "Ah, here are old friends," he said, picking up a volume of Macaulay's poetry from the table. He asked Mrs. Sexton to read Horatius at the Bridge, which he followed with The Battle of Ivry. Midnight found him still seated by the fire, repeating snatches of poetry. During his stay, Mrs. Sexton noted, the Titan War Secretary was replaced by the genial companion, the man of letters, the lover of nature, the real Stanton. For a few hours, Stanton allowed himself the distraction and the levity he had often decried in Lincoln. Stanton had journeyed south to confer with Sherman, concerned by reports of the general's hostile behavior toward the black refugees who were arriving by the thousands into his lines. It was said that Sherman opposed their employment as soldiers, drove them from his camp even when they were starving, and manifested toward them an almost criminal dislike. Sherman countered that the movement of his military columns was hindered by the crowds of helpless Negroes that flock after our armies, clogging my roads and eating up our substance. Military success, he felt, had to take precedence over treatment of the Negroes. In his conversations with Stanton, however, Sherman agreed to issue Special Field Orders No. 15, a temporary plan to allocate a plot of not more than 40 acres of tillable ground to help settle the tide of freed slaves along the coast of Georgia and on the neighboring islands. Stanton returned home feeling more at ease about the situation. In the weeks that followed, Congress followed up by creating a Freedmen's Bureau with authority to distribute lands and provide assistance to displaced refugees throughout the South. Nothing on the home front in January engaged Lincoln with greater urgency than the passage of the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. He had long feared that his Emancipation Proclamation would be discarded once the war came to an end. A question might be raised whether the proclamation was legally valid, he said. It might be added that it only aided those who came into our lines, or that it would have no effect upon the children of the slaves born hereafter. Passage of a constitutional amendment eradicating slavery once and for all would be a king's cure for all the evils. The previous spring, the 13th Amendment had passed in the Senate by 2/3, but failed to garner the necessary 2/3 vote in the House, where Republicans had voted aye and Democrats nay along nearly unanimous party lines. In his annual message in December, Lincoln had urged Congress to reconsider the measure. He acknowledged that he was asking the same body to debate the same question, but he hoped the intervening election had altered the situation. Republican gains in November ensured that if he called a special session after March 4th, the amendment would pass. Since it was only a question of time, how much better it would be if this Congress could complete the job, if Democrats as well as Republicans could be brought to support its passage in a show of bipartisan unity. Congressman James M. Ashley of Ohio reintroduced the measure into the House on January 6, 1865. Lincoln set to work at once to sway the votes of moderate Democrats and border state unionists. He invited individual House members to his office, dealing gracefully and effectively with each one. "I have sent for you as an old Whig friend," he told Missouri's James Rollins, "that I might make an appeal to you to vote for this amendment. It is going to be very close. A few votes, one way or the other, will decide it." He emphasized the importance of sending a signal to the South that the border states could no longer be relied upon to uphold slavery. This would bring the war, he predicted, rapidly to a close. When Rawlins agreed to support the amendment, Lincoln jumped from his chair and grasped the congressman's hands, expressing his profound gratitude. The two old Whigs then discussed the leanings of the various members of the Missouri delegation, determining which members might be persuaded. "Tell them of my anxiety to have the measure pass," Lincoln urged, "and let me know the prospect of the border state vote." He assigned two of his allies in the House to deliver the votes of two wavering members. When they asked how to proceed, he said, "I am President of the United States, clothed with great power. The abolition of slavery by constitutional provision settles the fate for all coming time, not only of the millions now in bondage, but of unborn millions to come. A measure of such importance that those two votes must be procured. I leave it to you to determine how it shall be done, but remember that I am President of the United States, clothed with immense power, and I expect you to procure those votes." It was clear to his emissaries that his powers extended to plumb assignments, pardons, campaign contributions, and government jobs for relatives and friends of faithful members. Brooklyn Democrat Moses F. Odell agreed to change his vote. When the session ended, he was given the lucrative post of Navy agent in New York. Elizabeth Blair noted that her father had successfully joined in the lobbying effort, persuading several members. Ashley learned that the Camden and Amboy Railroad could secure the vote of two New Jersey Democrats if Senator Sumner could be convinced to postpone a bill he had introduced to end the monopoly the railroad enjoyed. Unable to move Sumner, Ashley asked Lincoln to intervene. Lincoln regretfully replied that he could do nothing with Mr. Sumner in these matters, and feared if he tried, Sumner would be all the more resolute. As the vote neared, pressure intensified. The leader of the opposition was McClellan's running mate, Democrat George Pendleton of Ohio. "Though he had been defeated in the election," observed Senator James Blaine, "he returned to the House with increased prestige among his own political associates." Democrats who considered changing their vote were made to understand that dire consequences would follow if they failed to maintain the party line on an issue compromising the sanctity of states' rights and effecting a fundamental shift in the Constitution. Both sides knew that the outcome would be decided by the thinnest of margins. "We are like whalers," Lincoln observed, "who have been long on a chase. We have at last got the harpoon into the monster, but we must now look how we steer, or with one flop of his tail he will send us all into eternity." On the morning of the scheduled vote, Ashley feared that the entire effort would collapse. Rumors circulated that Confederate peace commissioners were on the way to Washington or had already arrived in the capital. "If it is true," Ashley urgently wrote to the president, "I fear we shall lose the bill." The Democratic leadership would prevail upon wavering party members, arguing that the amendment would lead the commissioners to abort the peace talks. "Please authorize me to contradict it if not true," Ashley entreated. "So far as I know," Lincoln promptly replied, "there are no peace commissioners in the city, or likely to be in it." Ashley later learned that Lincoln, in fact, had been informed that three peace commissioners were en route to Fort Monroe, but he could honestly, if insincerely, claim that no commissioners were in the capital city. Without this cunning evasion, Ashley believed, the proposed amendment would have failed. As the debate opened, Ashley acknowledged that never before, and certain I am that never again will I be seized with so strong a desire to give utterance to the thoughts and emotions which throbbed my heart and brain. The amendments passage would signal the complete triumph of a cause which, at the beginning of my political life, I had not hoped to live long enough to see. Ashley recalled every available foot of space, both in the galleries and on the floor of the house, was crowded at an early hour, and many hundreds could not get within hearing. Chief Justice Chase and the members of the Supreme Court were present, along with Seward, Fessenden, and Dennison, representing the cabinet. Dozens of senators had come to witness the historic debate, as had members of most foreign ministries. Ashley wisely decided to yield his time to the small band of Democrats who would support the amendment, but needed to justify their shift to constituents. He called first on Archibald McAllister. The Pennsylvania congressman explained that he had changed his mind when he saw that the only way to achieve peace was to destroy the cornerstone of the Southern Confederacy. His remarks brought forth applause from the galleries, as did those of his colleague Alexander Kofroth. "If by my action today I dig my political grave," the congressman from Somerset County proclaimed, "I will descend into it without a murmur." After every Democrat who wanted to speak had been heard, the voting began. Hundreds of tally sheets had been distributed on the floor and in the galleries, Ashley recorded. It appeared at first that the amendment had fallen two or three votes short of the requisite two-thirds margin. The floor was in tumult when Speaker Colfax stood to announce the final tally. His voice shaking, he said, "On the passage of the joint resolution to amend the Constitution of the United States, the ayes have 119, the noes 56. The constitutional majority of two-thirds having voted in the affirmative, the joint resolution has passed." Without the five Democrats who had changed their votes, the amendment would have lost. For a moment there was a pause of utter silence, Noah Brooks reported, as if the voices of the dense mass of spectators were choked by strong emotion. Then there was an explosion, a storm of cheers, the like of which probably no Congress of the United States ever heard before. "Before the members left their seats," Congressman Arnold recalled, "the roar of artillery from Capitol Hill announced to the people of Washington that the amendment had passed." Ashley brought to the War Department a list of all those who had voted in favor. Stanton ordered three additional batteries to fire 100 guns with their heaviest charges, while he slowly read each name aloud, proclaiming, "History will embalm them in great honor." Lincoln's friends raced to the White House to share the news. The passage of the resolution, recalled Arnold, filled his heart with joy. He saw in it the complete consummation of his own great work, the Emancipation Proclamation. The following evening, Lincoln spoke to celebrants gathered at the White House. "The occasion was one of congratulation to the country and to the whole world," he said. "But there is a task yet before us, to go forward and consummate by the votes of the states that which Congress so nobly began." The audience responded with cheers. "They will do it," was the confident cry. And indeed, the legislatures in 20 states acted almost immediately. Before the year 1865 was out, the requisite three-quarters had spoken, putting a dramatic end to the slavery issue that had disturbed the nation's tranquility from its earliest days. No praise must have been more welcome to Lincoln than that of his old critic, the fiery abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison. And to whom is the country more immediately indebted for this vital and saving amendment of the Constitution than perhaps to any other man? Garrison asked a cheering crowd at the Boston Music Hall. I believe I may confidently answer, to the humble rail splitter of Illinois, to the presidential chain breaker for millions of the oppressed, to Abraham Lincoln. The story of the peace commissioners, whose presence had almost derailed the vote on the new amendment, had begun with Francis Preston Blair. Lincoln's re-election had convinced the old editor that another attempt at peace might be successful. Lincoln remained unconvinced that talks at this juncture would be effective, but Blair was so anxious to try that Lincoln gave him a pass for Richmond. It was understood, however, that he was proceeding on his own, without authority to speak for the president. After leaving Lincoln, Blair wrote two letters to Jefferson Davis. The first, designed for public consumption, requested simply the privilege of visiting Richmond to inquire about the papers Blair had lost when General Early's troops took possession of his Silver Spring house. The second revealed that his main purpose in coming was to discuss the state of the affairs of our country. He promised to unbosom his heart frankly and without reserve, hopeful that some good might result. On January 11, 1865, the 73-year-old Blair arrived in Richmond, where he was greeted warmly by numerous old friends. Jefferson Davis's wife, Verena, threw her arms around him and said, "Oh, you rascal, I am overjoyed to see you." Seated with President Davis in the library of the Confederate White House, Blair conceded his proposal might be the dreams of an old man, but he was confident of Davis's practical good sense and utmost frankness. He reminded Davis of his own deep attachment to the South. Every drop of his own blood and his children's sprang from a Southern source. Davis responded with equal warmth, assuring Blair that he would never forget the many kindnesses exhibited by the Blairs toward the Davis family, and that even when dying they would be remembered in his prayers. Blair presented his proposal, which would essentially postpone the war between the North and the South while the armies allied against the French, who had invaded Mexico and installed a puppet regime in violation of the Monroe Doctrine. Davis agreed that nothing would better heal the raw emotions on both sides than to see the arms of our countrymen from the North and the South united in a war upon a foreign power. The specifics of this improbable and unauthorized plan, reminiscent of Seward's proposal 4 years earlier, were not discussed, though Davis agreed to send peace commissioners to Washington with a view to secure peace to the two countries. Though tired from his arduous journey back to Washington by carriage, train, and steamer, Blair rushed to the White House and delivered the Davis letter to the president. Lincoln consulted Stanton, who pointedly noted, "There are not two countries, and there never will be two countries. Tell Davis that if you treat for peace, it will be for this one country. Negotiations on any other basis are impossible." Lincoln immediately agreed. "You may say to him," Lincoln directed Blair, "that I have constantly been, am now, and shall continue, ready to receive any agent with the view of securing peace to the people of our one common country." Blair returned straight away to Richmond, with Lincoln's response, and Davis called a cabinet meeting at his home to discuss his next move. His advisers recognized the irreconcilable conflict between the concepts of two countries and one common country, but the insistent clamor for peace had convinced Davis to send three commissioners to Fort Monroe: Vice President Alexander Stevens, former United States Senator R.M.T. Hunter, and former Supreme Court Justice John A. Campbell. On Sunday, January 29th, a flag of truce flown at Petersburg announced the arrival of the commissioners. By common consent, all picket firing was suspended, the New York Herald reported, and the lines of both armies presented the appearance of a gala day. Viewed as harbingers of peace, the three gentlemen elicited prolonged and enthusiastic applause from both sides, revealing the depth of the soldiers' desire to end the fighting and return to their families and homes. One reporter noted that when rival songs were played by Southern and Northern bands, Dixie and Yankee Doodle Dandy, each side responded only to its own patriotic air. But when the band struck up Home Sweet Home, the opposing camps forgot their hostility and united in vociferous tribute to the common sentiment. A Union colonel escorted the commissioners to Grant's headquarters at City Point. "It was night when we arrived," Alexander Stevens later recalled. "There was nothing in Grant's appearance or surroundings which indicated his official rank. There were neither guards nor aides about him. I was instantly struck with the great simplicity and perfect naturalness of his manners, and the entire absence of everything like affectation, show, or even the usual military air or mien of men in his position. He was plainly attired, sitting in a log cabin, busily writing on a small table by a kerosene lamp. His conversation was easy and fluent, without the least effort or restraint." After talking for a while, Grant escorted them to the steamship Mary Martin, where he had arranged comfortable quarters for his three distinguished visitors. Though Grant was not authorized to discuss the peace mission itself, Stevens got the impression that he was very anxious for the return of peace and harmony throughout the country. Meanwhile, at Lincoln's request, Seward headed south to meet with the commissioners. "You will make known to them that three things are indispensable," Lincoln wrote. "The restoration of the national authority, no receding by the executive of the United States on the slavery question, no cessation of hostilities short of an end of the war." If these three conditions were accepted, he was to tell them that all other propositions would be met with a spirit of sincere liberality. After riding the train to Annapolis, Seward boarded Grant's flagship, the River Queen, and proceeded to Fort Monroe. Before Seward could interview the commissioners, word reached Lincoln that President Davis had instructed them to negotiate peace for two countries. The president felt he had no choice but to recall Seward until an urgent telegram from Grant changed his mind. Grant was convinced, he had written to Stanton, after talking with the three men, that their intentions are good, and he believed that their going back without any expression from anyone in authority will have a bad influence. Given the complexity of the situation, Grant wished that the president could meet with them personally. "Induced by a dispatch of General Grant," Lincoln promptly telegraphed Seward and Grant, "say to the gentlemen I will meet them personally at Fortress Monroe as soon as I can get there." Accompanied by a single valet and an overnight bag, the president left Washington 2 hours later on a train headed to Annapolis. There, the steamer Thomas Collier, supposed to be the fastest in the world, stood ready to take him to Fort Monroe. Upon getting out of the bay, noted a Herald correspondent who had boarded the vessel before the president arrived, we encountered large fields of ice, through which we passed slowly. The steamer finally arrived at Fort Monroe a little past 10 that evening, and Lincoln joined Seward on the River Queen. The four-hour meeting, known as the Hampton Roads Conference, took place the next day, in the saloon of the River Queen, which had been lashed to the Mary Martin the night before, and gaily decked out with a superabundance of streamers and flags. After everyone was introduced, Stevens opened the conversation with warm memories of his days as Lincoln's congressional colleague nearly two decades earlier. The president responded in a cheerful and cordial manner, Stevens recalled, as if the remembrance of those times had awakened in him a train of agreeable reflections. They talked for several minutes of old acquaintances before Stevens asked, "Well, Mr. President, is there no way of putting an end to the present trouble and bringing about a restoration of the general good feeling and harmony then existing between the different states and sections of the country?" The conversation that followed, Seward later wrote, was altogether informal. There was no attendance of secretaries, clerks, or other witnesses. Nothing was written or read. The only other person who entered the room was the steward, who came in occasionally to see if anything was wanted, and to bring in water, cigars, and other refreshments. In reply to the question posed by Stevens, Lincoln attested that there was but one way that he knew of, and that was, for those who were resisting the laws of the Union, to cease that resistance. Stevens countered with the hope for a temporary solution that would integrate their respective armies to fight the French, until the passions on both sides might cool. "I suppose you refer to something Mr. Blair has said," Lincoln replied. "Now, it is proper to state at the beginning that whatever he said was of his own accord. The restoration of the Union is a sine qua non with me." There could be no substantive talk of an armistice or postponement until the resistance ceased and the national authority was recognized. Attempting to circumvent this declaration, Hunter recalled that Charles I of England had entered repeatedly into arrangements with his adversaries despite ongoing hostilities. "I do not profess to be posted in history," Lincoln answered. "On all such matters I will turn you over to Seward. All I distinctly recollect about the case of Charles I is that he lost his head in the end." Judge Campbell then turned the conversation to the question of how restoration was to take place, supposing that the Confederate States were consenting to it. This opened a discussion of slavery, which Seward addressed by reciting, verbatim, from Lincoln's annual address, in which he had said that he would not attempt to retract or modify the Emancipation Proclamation, nor return to slavery any person who is free by the terms of that proclamation. Moreover, Seward said, he felt obliged to inform the commissioners that Congress had just passed a constitutional amendment banning slavery throughout the entire United States. They had clearly reached an impasse, but the conversation continued in an amicable tone. Lincoln let the commissioners know that he would be willing to be taxed to remunerate the Southern people for their slaves. He was fairly confident the people of the North would sustain him with an appropriation as high as $400 million for this purpose. On the question of some sort of postponement of hostilities prior to the end of the war, Lincoln was immovable. The conference drew to a close without agreement on any issue. Before any outcome was made public, the radicals had worked themselves into a fury of rage, certain that the president was about to give up the political fruits which had been already gathered from the long and exhausting military struggle. Fearing Lincoln would turn his back on emancipation, Thaddeus Stevens excoriated him on the floor of the House. In the Senate, the leading members of the Committee on the Conduct of the War roundly castigated the very idea of the conference, predicting that "we shall be sold out, and that the peace we shall obtain, if any we do, will dishonor us." Both branches passed a resolution calling for a full report on the proceedings. Even Stanton worried that the president's kind-heartedness might lead him to make some admission which the astute Southerners would willfully misconstrue and twist to serve their purpose. Lincoln's report on the conference, complete with the telegrams and documents preceding it, was read, amidst a breathless silence in the hall, every member being in his seat. A low gush of satisfaction broke out when the phrase, "One common country," was read in the Blair letter, and an involuntary burst followed the enunciation of the three conditions of peace given to Seward. Noah Brooks observed that, as the reading of the message and documents went on, the change which took place in the moral atmosphere of the Hall of the House was obvious. The appearance of grave intentness passed away, and members smilingly exchanged glances as they began to appreciate Lincoln's sagacious plan for unmasking the craftiness of the rebel leaders. When the presentation was done, there was an instant and irrepressible storm of applause. It was like a burst of refreshing rain after a long and heartbreaking drought. Representatives vied with one another to praise the president. Even Thaddeus Stevens paid a high tribute to the sagacity, wisdom, and patriotism of President Lincoln. Indeed, Harper's Weekly observed, nothing but the foolish assumption of 4 years ago that Mr. Lincoln was unfit for his office could explain the fatuous predictions that he would flinch and falter before the Southern delegates. If there is any man in the country who comprehends the scope of the war more fully than the president, who is he? We venture to say that there is no man in our history who has shown a more felicitous combination of temperament, conviction, and ability to grapple with a complication like that in which this country is involved than Abraham Lincoln. Jefferson Davis pragmatically employed the failed conference to incite greater effort on the battlefield, pledging that he would be willing to yield up everything he had on earth before acceding to northern demands. He predicted that before another year had passed, the South would be able to secure peace on its own terms, with separation and slavery intact. "I can have no common country with the Yankees," he announced. "My life is bound up in the Confederacy, and if any man supposes that under any circumstances I can be an agent of reconstruction of the Union, he has mistaken every element of my nature." Still, Lincoln did not relinquish hope that he might somehow bring the war to an honorable end before tens of thousands more young men had to die. Following his Hampton Roads suggestion of compensated emancipation, he drafted a proposal that Congress empower him to pay $400 million to the southern states, distributed according to their respective slave populations. The first half would be paid if all resistance to the national authority came to an end by April 1st. The second half would be allocated if the 13th Amendment were ratified by July 1st. At that point, with the armed rebellion at an end, the Union restored, and slavery eradicated, all political offenses will be pardoned, and all property, except slaves, liable to confiscation or forfeiture, will be released. Furthermore, liberality will be recommended to Congress upon all points not lying within executive control. The proposition met with unanimous disapproval from the cabinet, all of whom were present except Seward. The earnest desire of the president to conciliate and effect peace was manifest, Wells recorded. But there may be such a thing as so overdoing as to cause a distrust or adverse feeling. Usher believed that the radicals in Congress would make it the occasion of a violent assault on the president. Stanton had long maintained that it was unnecessary and wasteful to talk about compensation for slaves already freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. Fessenden declared that the only way to effectually end the war was by force of arms, and that until the war was thus ended, no proposition to pay money would come from us. Lincoln pointed out that the sum he proposed was simply the cost of continuing the war for another 100 or 200 days. to say nothing of the lives lost and property destroyed. Still, the cabinet was adamant. "You are all against me," Lincoln said, his voice filled with sadness. His heart was so fully enlisted in behalf of such a plan that he would have followed it if only a single member of his cabinet had supported him, Usher thought. Had Seward been there, Usher mused, he would probably have approved the measure. Without a trace of support among his colleagues at the table, Lincoln felt compelled to forsake his proposition, which, in any event, as Jefferson Davis had made clear, was unacceptable to the Confederacy. So, the war would continue until the South capitulated. Meanwhile, the war front continued to generate good news for the Union. After capturing Savannah, Sherman headed north to Columbia, reaching the state capital of South Carolina on February 17th. Columbia's fall led to the evacuation of Charleston. Stanton ordered a national salute fired from every fort arsenal and army headquarters of the United States in honor of the restoration of the flag of the Union upon Fort Sumter. In Washington, the National Republican noted, the flash and smoke were visible from the tops of buildings on the avenue, and the thunder of the guns was heard in all parts of the city. That evening, Lincoln was in cheerful spirits as he relaxed with Seward, Wells, and General Hooker in his office. "General H. thinks it the brightest day in 4 years," Wells recorded in his diary. The following day, however, Browning found Lincoln more depressed than he had seen him in the 4 years of his presidency. His low spirits were probably caused by the pending execution of John Yates Beale, a former Confederate captain who had been tried and found guilty as a spy. In the fall of 1864, when Confederate agents based in Canada were pursuing plots to disrupt the draft and influence the elections, Beale had led a team of raiders in a daring and elaborate scheme to commandeer Union ships in the Great Lakes area, destroy railroad lines, and liberate Confederate prisoners in Ohio. The commander of the army in New York State, General John A. Dix, was unyielding in his belief that Beale must be executed as an example to others. But Beale came from a prominent Virginia family, and a wide array of supporters petitioned Lincoln for clemency, including Orville Browning, Monty Blair, 8 dozen congressmen, and 6 United States senators. They argued that Beale was acting as a commissioned officer in the Confederate Army, and should not be treated as a robber, brigand, and pirate. The case troubled Lincoln greatly, but he felt compelled to support General Dix. "I had to stand firm," he told an acquaintance a few weeks later, "and I even had to turn away his poor sister when she came and begged for his life, and let him be executed. And he was executed, and I can't get the distress out of my mind yet." The week before his second inaugural on March 4th, Lincoln announced that he would not receive callers, except members of the cabinet, for any purpose whatever between the hours of 3 and 7 o'clock p.m. He needed solitude to work on his inaugural speech. The hopeful condition of the Union cause had brought thousands of visitors to Washington, the National Republican reported. They were anxious not only to partake of the inaugural revelries, but to share in the general elation that pervaded the Capitol. The city was so overcrowded that the parlors of all the leading hotels were occupied by ladies and gentlemen sitting up all night because no beds could be found for them. Frederick Douglass decided to join in the grand procession of citizens from all parts of the country. Blacks had been excluded from previous inaugural festivities, but with soldiers of both races mingling their blood, it seemed to him that it was not too great an assumption for a colored man to offer his congratulations to the president with those of other citizens. The evening before the inauguration, he visited Chase's 6th Street home. There, he later recalled, he helped Kate in placing over her honored father's shoulders the new robe then being made in which he was to administer the oath to the re-elected president. As he looked at the new Chief Justice, Douglas recollected the early anti-slavery days of their first acquaintance. Chase had welcomed him to his home and his table, when to do so was a strange thing. The steady rain on the morning of March 4th did not dampen the spirits of the estimated 50,000 citizens gathered at the Capitol to witness the inauguration. Invited guests poured into the Senate chamber for the first part of the ceremony, which included a farewell address by the outgoing Vice President, Hannibal Hamlin, and the swearing-in of Andrew Johnson. Shortly before noon, a stir in the galleries revealed the arrival of the notables, generals, governors, the justices of the Supreme Court, the cabinet members, led by Seward, and finally, the president himself, whose chair was positioned in the middle of the front row. Mary Lincoln was seated in the diplomatic gallery, surrounded by members of the foreign ministries. One ambassador was so stiff with gold lace, Noah Brooks observed, that he could not sit down except with great difficulty, and had to unbutton before he could get his feet on the floor. After Hamlin delivered a graceful farewell address, Andrew Johnson rose to take the oath. His face was extraordinarily red, his balance precarious. He appeared to observers to be in a state of manifest intoxication. For 20 long minutes he spoke incoherently, repeatedly declaring his plebeian background and his pride that such a humble man could rise from the ranks, under the Constitution, to the proud position of the second place in the gift of the people. Pivoting to face the Supreme Court justices, he reminded them that they also derived their power from the people. Then he spoke to the members of the cabinet, insisting they too were creatures of the people. He addressed each secretary by name, Mr. Seward, Mr. Stanton, and down the ranks, until he reached Gideon Welles, whose name he could not remember. Seemingly nonplussed, he turned to someone near him and loudly inquired, "What's the name of the Secretary of the Navy?" Continuing his tirade, he ignored Hamlin's pointed reminder that the hour for the inauguration ceremony had passed. The crowd stirred uneasily, and the men on the dais tried, with varying success, to conceal their dismay. Stanton looked like a petrified man, Noah Brooks observed. "All this is in wretched bad taste," Speed whispered to Welles. "The man is certainly deranged." Welles whispered to Stanton that Johnson is either drunk or crazy. Dennison, the new Postmaster General, was red and white by turns, while Justice Samuel Nelson's jaw dropped clean down in blank horror. Seward and Lincoln alone appeared unruffled. Seward remained as serene as summer, charitably suggesting to Welles that Johnson's performance was a byproduct of emotion on returning and revisiting the Senate. Lincoln listened in silence, patiently waiting for the harangue to end, his eyes shut so that no one could discern his discomfort. "You need not be scared," he said a few days later. Johnson had made a bad slip, but was not a drunkard. When Johnson finished at last, the audience proceeded outside to the east front of the Capitol for the inaugural ceremony. As the president appeared on the platform, observed Noah Brooks, the sun, which had been obscured all day, burst forth in its unclouded meridian splendor and flooded the spectacle with glory and light. It seemed to many, including the superstitious Lincoln, an auspicious omen, as did the appearance of the newly completed Capitol Dome, topped with the Statue of Freedom. If the spirited crowd expected a speech exalting recent Union victories, they were disappointed. in keeping with his lifelong tendency to consider all sides of a troubled situation, Lincoln urged a more sympathetic understanding of the nation's alienated citizens in the South. There were no unbridgeable differences, he insisted. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not, that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. In his Springfield speech a decade earlier, Lincoln had maintained that he could not condemn the South for an inability to end slavery, when he himself knew of no easy solution. Now the president suggested that God had given to both North and South this terrible war as punishment for their shared sin of slavery. Speaking with the eloquence of the prophets, he continued, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue, until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Drawing upon the rare wisdom of a temperament that consistently displayed uncommon magnanimity toward those who opposed him, he then issued his historic plea to his fellow countrymen. "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." More than any of his other speeches, the second inaugural fused spiritual faith with politics. While Lincoln might have questioned the higher force that shaped human ends, as he became involved in matters of the gravest importance, his friend Leonard Swett observed, a feeling of religious reverence and belief in God, his justice and overruling power, increased upon him. If his devotion were determined by his lack of faith in ceremonials and forms, or by his failure to observe the Sabbath very scrupulously, Swett added, he would fall far short of the standard. However, if he were judged by the higher rule of purity of conduct, of honesty of motive, of unyielding fidelity to the right, or by his powerful belief in the great laws of truth, the rigid discharge of duty, his accountability to God, then he was undoubtedly full of natural religion, for he believed in God as much as the most approved church member. His address completed, the president turned to Chief Justice Salmon Chase, who administered the oath of office. The crowd cheered loudly, the artillery fired a round of salutes, the band played, and the peaceful ceremony drew to a close. That evening, the gates of the White House were opened for a public reception, attended by the largest crowd that has been here yet, according to Nicolay. The president was reported to be in excellent spirits as he tirelessly shook the hands of the more than 5,000 people who came to show their respect and affection. "It was a grand ovation of the people to their president," Commissioner French observed, and Mary vowed to remain till morning rather than have the door closed on a single visitor. French estimated that Lincoln shook hands at the rate of 100 every 4 minutes. Frederick Douglass would always remember the events of that evening. On reaching the door, two policemen stationed there took me rudely by the arm and ordered me to stand back, for their directions were to admit no persons of my color. Douglass assured the officers there must be some mistake, for no such order could have emanated from President Lincoln, and that if he knew I was at the door, he would desire my admission. His assumption was later confirmed when he discovered there were no orders from Mr. Lincoln or from anyone else. They were simply complying with an old custom. The impasse continued for a few moments, until Douglass recognized a gentleman going in and asked him to tell the president that he was unable to gain entry. Minutes later, the word came back to admit Douglass. I walked into the spacious East Room amid a scene of elegance such as in this country I had never before witnessed. Douglass had no difficulty spotting Lincoln, who stood like a mountain pine high above the others, he recalled, in his grand simplicity and home-like beauty. Recognizing me, even before I reached him, he exclaimed, so that all around could hear him, "Here comes my friend, Douglass." Taking me by the hand, he said, "I am glad to see you. I saw you in the crowd today, listening to my inaugural address. How did you like it?" Douglass was embarrassed to detain the president in conversation when there were thousands waiting to shake hands, but Lincoln insisted. "You must stop a little, Douglass. There is no man in the country whose opinion I value more than yours. I want to know what you think of it." For a moment these two remarkable men stood together amid the sea of faces. Lincoln knew that Douglass would speak his mind, just as he always had. "Mr. Lincoln," Douglass said finally, "that was a sacred effort." Lincoln's face lit up with delight. "I am glad you liked it," he replied. A few days later, Lincoln provided his own assessment to Thurlow Weed, predicting that the address would wear as well as, perhaps better than, anything he had written, though he did not believe it would be immediately popular. Men are not flattered by being shown that there has been a difference of purpose between the Almighty and them. Just as Lincoln surmised, the speech drew criticisms from several quarters. The Democratic New York World faulted Lincoln for his substitution of religion for statesmanship, while the Tribune charged that the stern biblical overtones would impede any chance for peace. Many others, however, recognized the historic weight of the address. "That rail-splitting lawyer is one of the wonders of the day," Charles Francis Adams, Jr. wrote to his father in London. "The inaugural strikes me, in its grand simplicity and directness, as being for all time the historical keynote of this war." The London Spectator, previously critical of Lincoln, agreed with young Adams, judging the address as by far the noblest which any American president has yet uttered to an American Congress. Praise for the speech mingled with praise for Lincoln himself. The Spectator suggested that it was divine inspiration or providence that brought the Republican Convention in 1860 to choose Lincoln, the village lawyer, over Seward. Congressman Isaac Arnold overheard a conversation between a celebrated minister and an unidentified New York statesman, whom one historian suggests was likely William Henry Seward himself. "The president's inaugural is the finest state paper in all history," the minister declared. "Yes," the New Yorker answered, "and as Washington's name grows brighter with time, so it will be with Lincoln's. A century from today, that inaugural will be read as one of the most sublime utterances ever spoken by man. Washington is the great man of the era of the Revolution. So will Lincoln be of this. But Lincoln will reach the higher position in history." Perhaps the most surprising contemporaneous evaluation of Lincoln's leadership appeared in the extreme secessionist paper, the Charleston Mercury. "He has called around him in council," the Mercury marveled, "the ablest and most earnest men of his country. Where he has lacked in individual ability, learning, experience, or statesmanship, he has sought it and found it. Force, energy, brains, earnestness, he has collected around him in every department. Were he not a blackguard and an unscrupulous knave in the end," the Mercury concluded, "he would undoubtedly command our respect as a ruler. We turn our eyes to Richmond, and the contrast is appalling, sickening to the heart." The editors of the Mercury would have been even more astonished if they had an inkling of the truth recognized by those closer to Lincoln. His political genius was not simply his ability to gather the best men of the country around him, but to impress upon them his own purpose, perception, and resolution at every juncture. With respect to Lincoln's cabinet, Charles Dana observed, "It was always plain that he was the master, and they were the subordinates. They constantly had to yield to his will, and if he ever yielded to them, it was because they convinced him that the course they advised was judicious and appropriate." Chapter 26. The Final Weeks. As Lincoln began his second term, he was, in mind, body, and nerves, a very different man, John Hay observed, from the one who had taken the oath in 1861. He continued always the same kindly, genial, and cordial spirit he had been at first, but the boisterous laughter became less frequent year by year. The eye grew veiled by constant meditation on momentous subjects. The air of reserve and detachment from his surroundings increased. 4 years of relentless strain had touched Lincoln's spirit and his countenance. The aged, wearied face in the life mask cast by Clark Mills in the spring of 1865 barely resembled the mold Leonard Volk had taken 5 years earlier. "In 1860," noted John Hay, "the large, mobile mouth is ready to speak, to shout, or laugh. The bold, curved nose is broad and substantial, with spreading nostrils. It is a face full of life, of energy, of vivid aspiration." The second life mask, with its lined brow and cavernous cheeks, has a look as of one on whom sorrow and care had done their worst. The whole expression is of unspeakable sadness and all-sufficing strength. That inner strength had sustained Lincoln all his life, but his 4 years as president had immeasurably enhanced his self-confidence. Despite the appalling pressures he had faced from his very first day in office, he had never lost faith in himself. In fact, he was the one who had sustained the spirits of those around him time and again, gently guiding his colleagues with good humor, energy, and steady purpose. He had learned from early mistakes, transcended the jealousy of rivals, and his insight into men and events had deepened with each passing year. Though a tired spot remained within that no rest or relaxation could restore, he was ready for the arduous tasks of the next 4 years. Settling into his daily routine after the inauguration, Lincoln was determined to avoid the thousands of office seekers who again descended like Egyptian locusts upon Washington. "The bare thought of going through again what I did the first year here would crush me," he confessed. In the first months of his presidency, he had been disparaged for allowing office seekers to accost him at all hours, consuming his energy and disrupting his concentration. Nicolay and Hay had tried to get him to be more methodical, to close his door to outsiders for longer periods. But at the time, he had insisted that they don't want much, they get but little, and I must see them. Experience had finally taught him that he must set priorities and concentrate on the vital questions of war and reconstruction confronting his administration. "I think now that I will not remove a single man except for delinquency," he told New Hampshire Senator Clark. "To remove a man is very easy," he commented to another visitor. "But when I go to fill his place, there are 20 applicants, and of these I must make 19 enemies." With two classes of office seekers, however, he was prepared to take a personal interest: artists and disabled veterans. He expressed to Seward his hope that consul positions could be offered to facilitate artists a little in their profession, mentioning in particular a poet and a sculptor he wished to help. To General Scott, who was working with the Sanitary Commission to find government jobs for disabled veterans, Lincoln emphasized that the commission should at all times be ready to recognize the paramount claims of the soldiers of the nation in the disposition of public trusts. With his cabinet, he was satisfied. The only change he made after the inauguration was to replace Treasury Secretary William Pitt Fessenden with the banker Hugh McCulloch. When he had assumed the post the previous summer, Fessenden had been assured that he could leave once the finances of the country were in good shape. By the spring of 1865, the Treasury was stable, and when Maine re-elected him to the Senate for a term to begin on March 4th, Fessenden felt free to resign. Lincoln was sorry to lose his brilliant, hard-working secretary. Fessenden, too, parted from the president with regret. During his tenure at the Treasury, his initial critical attitude toward Lincoln had been transformed into warm admiration. "I desire gratefully to acknowledge the kindness and consideration with which you have invariably treated me," he wrote to the president, "and to assure you that in retiring I carry with me great and increased respect for your personal character and for the ability which has marked your administration." Noting that the prolonged struggle for national life was finally nearing a successful conclusion, he went on, "No one can claim to have so largely contributed as the chosen chief magistrate of this great people." Hugh McCulloch was entirely familiar with Treasury operations, having served as controller of the currency. When Lincoln first approached him, however, he was nervous about accepting the position. "I should be glad to comply with your wishes," he told Lincoln, "if I did not distrust my ability to do what will be required of the Secretary of the Treasury." Lincoln cheerfully replied, "I will be responsible for that, and so I reckon we will consider the matter settled." McCulloch would remain at his post for 4 years, and was never sorry that he had acceded to Lincoln's wishes. The only other cabinet change Lincoln anticipated was in the Department of the Interior, where, in several months' time, he intended to replace Usher with Senator James Harlan of Iowa. The time had also come for John Nicolay and John Hay to move on. The two secretaries had served Lincoln exceptionally well, introducing a systematic order into the president's vast correspondence and drafting replies to the great majority of letters he received. In their small offices on the second floor of the White House, they had served as gatekeepers, tactfully holding back the crush of senators, congressmen, generals, diplomats, and office seekers endeavoring to gain access to the president. John Hay was particularly adept at keeping the throngs entertained. "No one could be in his presence, even for a few moments," Hay's college roommate recalled, "without falling under the spell which his conversation and companionship invariably cast upon all who came within his influence." Lincoln had increased their responsibilities with each passing year. In 1864, Nicolay functioned as the unofficial manager of Lincoln's re-election campaign and was dispatched as his personal emissary to ease tensions in Missouri and New York. Hay was chosen to accompany Greeley to Canada, to carry sensitive messages back and forth to Capitol Hill, and to enroll Confederate voters under Lincoln's plan for the reconstruction of Florida. More essential to Lincoln than the duties they so faithfully discharged was the camaraderie the young assistants provided him. They were part of his family, like sons during the troubled days and nights of his first term. They would listen spellbound when he recited Shakespeare or told another tale from his endless store. Throughout their years in the White House, they offered Lincoln conversation, undivided loyalty, and love. They were awake late at night when he could not sleep, up early in the morning to share the latest news, offering the lonely president round-the-clock companionship. At the outset, Hay had been dumbfounded by the haphazard administrative style of the man he nicknamed the Ancient or the Tycoon. Something of an intellectual snob, the young college graduate had betrayed early on a hint of condescension toward his self-taught boss. Proximity to the president soon altered his opinion. He had come to believe by 1863 that the hand of God had put the prairie lawyer in the White House. If the patent leather kid glove set did not yet appreciate this giant of a man, it was because they know no more of him than an owl does of a comet blazing into his blinking eyes. By the spring of 1865, Nicolay, soon to marry Thurina Bates, was contemplating the purchase of a newspaper in Washington or Baltimore, while Hay wanted time for his studies and his active social life, too long constrained by 14-hour workdays. While they would both miss Lincoln, they were glad to escape the constant struggles with Mary, the Hellcat, as they irreverently called her, who still resented their claims on her husband's attention. Indeed, soon after Lincoln's re-election, Mary had enlisted the help of Dr. Anson Henry in an effort to replace Nicolay with the journalist Noah Brooks. Nicolay had apparently tried to talk with Lincoln about his problems with Mary, but the president had refused any such discussion. Seward found worthy alternatives for both Nicolay and Hay. When the consulate in Paris opened up in March, he recommended Nicolay for the job. The president agreed, understanding the significance of the opportunity for his loyal assistant. "So important an appointment has rarely been conferred on one so young," the National Republican commented when the Senate confirmed Nicolay without a dissenting vote. Nicolay was thrilled. The position paid $5,000 a year, allowing him to start married life on solid ground. Once Nicolay was confirmed, Seward turned his attentions to Hay, with whom he had become especially close over the years. Many nights, Hay had wandered over to Seward's house, where he was certain to find a good meal, vivid conversation, and a warm welcome. Moreover, in watching Seward and Lincoln together, Hay had recognized that the Secretary of State had been the first cabinet member to recognize Lincoln's personal preeminence. In mid-March, Seward arranged for Hay to receive an appointment as Secretary of the Legation in Paris. "It was entirely unsolicited and unexpected," Hay told his brother Charles. "It is a pleasant and honorable way of leaving my present post, which I should have left in any event very soon." He had thought of returning to Warsaw, Illinois, but Paris, France was far more exciting. Hay planned to stay at the White House for another month or so, until arrangements were completed for Noah Brooks to assume his duties. Then he and Nicolay would sail for Europe to begin their new adventures. "It will be exceedingly pleasant," Nicolay said, "for both of us to be there at the same time." Spring seemed to revive the spirits of Mary Lincoln, who invariably sank into depression each February with the anniversary of Willie's death. "We are having charming weather," she wrote to her friend Abram Wakeman on March 20th. "We went to the opera on Saturday Eve. Mr. Sumner accompanied us. We had a very gay little time. Mr. S., when he throws off his heavy manner, as he often does, can make himself very, very agreeable. Last evening he again joined our little coterie, and tomorrow eve we all go again to hear Robin Adair, sung in La Dame Blanche by Habermann. This is always the pleasant time to me in W. springtime. Some of the most pleasant senators' families remain until June, and all ceremony with each other is laid aside. A few days later, she wrote a note to Sumner, telling him that she would be sending along a copy of Louis Napoleon's manuscript on Julius Caesar, which she had just received from the State Department and knew he would want to read. "In the coming summer," she promised, "I shall peruse it myself, for I have so sadly neglected the little French I fancied so familiar to me." Like his mother, Tad Lincoln possessed an emotional temperament much like an April day, sunning all over with laughter one moment, the next crying as though his heart would break. The painter Francis Carpenter recounted an incident when photographers from Brady's studio set up their equipment in an unoccupied room that Tad had turned into a little theater. Taking great offense at the occupation of his room without his consent, Tad locked the door and hid the key, preventing the photographers from retrieving their chemicals and supplies. Carpenter pleaded with Tad to unlock the door, but he refused. Finally, the president had to intervene. He left his office and returned a few minutes later with the key. "Though Tad was violently excited when I went to him," Lincoln told Carpenter, "I said, 'Tad, do you know you are making your father a great deal of trouble?' He burst into tears, instantly giving me up the key." Most of the time, however, Tad was so full of life and vigor, recalled John Hay, so bubbling over with health and high spirits, that he kept the house alive with his pranks and his fantastic enterprises. From dawn to dusk, you could hear his shrill pipe resounding through the dreary corridors of the executive residence, and when the president laid down his weary pen toward midnight, he generally found his infant goblin asleep under his table, or roasting his curly head by the open fireplace, and the tall chief would pick up the child and trudge off to bed with the drowsy little burden on his shoulder, stooping under the doors and dodging the chandeliers. Though Tad never developed a love of books, and felt he could not waste time in learning to spell, he had a clever, intuitive mind and was a good judge of character. He treated flatterers and office seekers with a curious coolness and contempt, marveled Hay, but he often espoused the cause of some poor widow or tattered soldier whom he found waiting in the anterooms. His enterprising nature and natural shrewdness would augur well for him once his schooling was completed. With all his heart, Lincoln loved his little sprite. In late March, Lincoln, Mary, and Tad journeyed to City Point to visit General Grant. For Lincoln, the 18-day sojourn was his longest break from Washington in 4 years. Grant had issued the invitation at the suggestion of his wife, Julia, who had been struck by constant newspaper reports of the exhausted appearance of the president. Grant worried, at first, about the propriety of issuing an invitation when the president could visit without waiting to be asked. But on March 20th, he wrote a note to Lincoln. "Can you not visit City Point for a day or two? I would like very much to see you, and I think the rest would do you good." Delighted with the idea, Lincoln asked the Navy Department to make arrangements for a ship to carry him south. Assistant Secretary Fox was not happy to be assigned the task, for he believed the president was incurring great risk in making the journey. To minimize danger, he ordered John Barnes, commander of the Bat, a fast-moving gunboat, to report to the Washington Navy Yard at once. Work immediately commenced on the interior of the armed ship to make alterations necessary to ensure the personal comfort of the president as long as he desired to make the Bat his home. To discuss the meals and amenities